I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times.
The eyes to the right, 242. The nose to the left, 391. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock.
That was the Speaker of the British House of Commons, John Bercow, announcing last night that Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal to leave the European Union had been defeated. She had been negotiating with the EU about the terms of the exit that is scheduled to happen on March 29th. That's just a few weeks away. May, nursing a hoarse voice, expressed her regret after the vote.
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker, I profoundly regret the decision that this House has taken tonight. I continue to believe that by far the best outcome is that the United Kingdom leaves the European Union in an orderly fashion with a deal. And that the deal we've negotiated is the best and indeed the only deal available.
There is a vote today on a no-deal Brexit, whether to leave the EU without a deal, and a vote tomorrow about whether to postpone the March 29th deadline. Well, what a mess. We wanted to understand more about what this all means and what happens next. And we asked James Blitz to join us. In fact, he's joining us from London, and he's the Whitehall editor for the Financial Times. He writes their Brexit briefing. And James Blitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in our Philadelphia studio is Daniel Kellerman, and he's a political science professor at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick campus, where he is the Jean Monnet Chair in EU Politics. And Daniel Kellerman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. James Blitz, let me begin with you. What does this second vote, and I guess second defeat for Theresa May, what does that mean?
Well, what it means, very briefly, is that the United Kingdom is in a full-scale political crisis of a kind that it's nobody, certainly myself, we can't remember for a very, very long period of time, if ever, certainly since the war. The situation now is that Mrs. May's deal has been defeated twice, and we're now in a situation where the British House of Commons has to decide what the next steps are. What are we going to do? Are we going to have a second referendum? Are we going to try and have a different type of deal, one which takes us closer to the European Union than she would have liked in hers? Are we going to stay inside the customs union arrangement of the European Union? All of those things have got to be decided by the House of Commons, but it's very unclear what the future course of events will be.
Which is, of course, a very disturbing situation to be in, Daniel Kellerman. Do you see the crisis the way James Blitz does, something as serious as World War II?
Yes, I do. This is a profound crisis, and we're seeing the party system in the UK kind of in meltdown, with the parties splintering apart on this issue. And I think in a large sense, really what we're seeing is that there was a sort of set of delusions that some of the Brexiteers held about what they thought Brexit might look like, kind of having their cake and eating it. And that's finally crashing into reality as we approach the end game and the tough choices have to be made.
When you say delusions, delusions about what?
Well, essentially, people were promised that they could still have all the economic benefits of the EU, access to its market, trade, etc., but no longer be subject to its rules and to the European Court of Justice, and sort of that, yeah, they could have their cake and eat it. And it turns out you can't, right? And so the choices are, do you distance yourself more from the European market, from its customs union, with the economic pain that will entail, or do you go in the other direction?
James, let me go back to you. As you said, there is what they're calling the no-deal Brexit vote today. First of all, what is that deal, and what's the chance of its passage or failure?
Yes, as you say, the House of Commons will today vote on whether we should leave the European Union on the 29th of March, just 16 days from now, without a deal at all. It is almost 100% certain that the House of Commons will vote against that outcome. And that is good news, because I think most economists, most business people would argue that a no-deal Brexit, Britain leaving the single market, the customs union, the EU, to which it's been a member for 46 years, just overnight like that, would be catastrophic for the UK economy. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that. So I think that is going to be passed by MPs. The difficult thing is what happens then. It's very likely that tomorrow the House of Commons will go on to say, we want an extension of the Article 50 process. That's the process under which the UK has to negotiate a new deal and leave by the 29th of March. So the House of Commons will vote to have an extension, to want an extension. The trouble is that extension has got to be agreed with the European Union and by each of its 27 member states. And unless the House of Commons and the government set out what they want that extension for, it's not clear that it will be agreed with the EU. And that's one of the difficulties that arises. Parliament does have to now say, having rejected May's deal, what it wants to happen. As I said, does it want a second referendum on the whole thing? Does it want to have a closer trading relationship? What does it want? If it can't agree on that and there isn't a majority for it, then there is a risk that we will simply slide out without a deal. Catastrophe, as I say. Because there's no consensus around anything.
A kind of a version, I guess, of no-deal Brexit. And I let me go back to you, Daniel Kellerman. March 29th is a little more than 2 weeks away. That is a lot to pack in, not just in England, but also with the EU, to pack in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that in terms of the terminology, it's important. No-deal Brexit, that very term can be misleading because it sort of leads people to think, oh, we don't have a deal, we stay as we are. But that's not what happened. As James said, we're heading toward a cliff edge. So no deal means going over the cliff with no safeguards, no process for withdrawal, et cetera. And that would be, as he said, extremely economically catastrophic for the UK. So you know, the UK is going to have to decide, you know, if they're going to ask for this extension. But the EU will only give that extension, you know, for reasons they find justifiable. So if the UK says we want to hold a second referendum, yes. If they say we're going to go to new elections, maybe. But one thing I would add, that for the EU, when they consider this possibility of an extension, they have another deadline in mind that's looming, which is the European Parliament, which is the kind of legislative body of the EU, has elections coming up on the 23rd of May. And if the UK asks for an extension and remains in the EU, right, at that time, well, they would have to participate in those elections and run members of the European Parliament. And the EU was assuming they'd be out by then. So that is very destabilizing also. So that's another looming deadline.
James Bliss, let me go back to you. And this was passed, Brexit was passed a couple of years ago by a slim margin. If it were put to the voters today in Great Britain, how do you think they would vote?
Well, all the signs are that the result that we had in June 2016 wouldn't be significantly different. I mean, if you look at opinion polling over the last 2.5 years, it has shown a slight increase for those who would like the UK to remain in the EU. So in 2016, we had a vote which was 52-48 to leave. Today, most polling shows that it's around 54-46 to stay. But the trouble is that that is really a very small difference in electoral terms. And in the 2016 poll, things changed an awful lot during the campaign. So one of the difficulties, I think, if we held a second referendum, is it's not clear you would get a very different result. And even if you got a victory for Remain of, say, 54-46 or something like that, a lot of people would say, well, you know, it's overturned the original vote we had without really having a very different outcome. So there'll be a sense of stalemate, and there'll be a sense that democracy has been overturned. So even though there are a lot of people who say the whole path that we're on to leave the EU is wrong, economically mistaken, and so on and so forth, those people still hold back and say, well, look, we really do have to leave in the end, because to overturn that result would be anti-democratic. And a lot of people say there would be a certain amount of civil unrest in the UK because leavers would be incredibly angry. So the bottom line is that the polling hasn't changed enough in across Britain to force the political class at Westminster to turn around and say, let's have a second referendum. There just hasn't been a big enough shift.
Let me go back to you, Daniel Kellerman, and some of the early proponents, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage. Where are they today? Are we hearing them speak out as England and Britain tries to figure out what to do about Brexit?
Yes, and there's a lot of voices within the parliament. There's a kind of faction, the ERG group, which is the sort of hardcore Brexiteers. And one sort of bizarre thing to consider is that Theresa May's deal, for all its flaws that one might point out, it was at least going to allow the UK to leave on schedule, which is what those hardcore Brexiteers would want, you think. Yet they voted against that deal, right, just now, yesterday, because in essence they argue, well, it's not a pure enough Brexit. It's not the kind of Brexit they had in mind. It leaves the UK too tied to the EU, right, and potentially stuck in this thing called the backstop, which we can talk
about. We will get to that.
Yeah, yes. We'll get to that. And so they voted against the deal. So in a sense, they just took a vote that would actually increase the chance through a second referendum or something else that the UK stays in.
Which makes me want to turn back to you, James Blitz, then, because what's so interesting in my very cursory reading of Brexit is just all these very kind of strange bedfellows that have come together either as remainers or leavers of the EU.
Yeah, I suppose there are strange bedfellows. There are quite a number of Labour MPs, for example, on the centre-left of politics who do want to leave the EU because they believe that that's what their constituents want first of all, and they don't want to go against the views of their constituents. And those people are allied to some degree with the right of the Conservative Party. So you do have some very strange bedfellows. And a lot of people say that our party political system is now in a state of chaos because within each party, you basically have very different views on what the course of events should be. Within the Labour Party, you have people who are very committed to leaving the EU and others who want to stay. And conversely, within the Conservative Party, the leadership definitely wants to leave, but there are quite a few Conservative MPs who would still like a second referendum.
James, we're almost up on a break here, but what's the future for Theresa May, the Prime Minister?
Well, I think Theresa May isn't going to be kicked out of power until we've got some kind of resolution to this. Because if she were to be removed from office, then we would enter an even deeper political crisis because the Conservative Party would have to go through a very lengthy process of choosing somebody else. And that isn't going to get us very far. So my view at the moment is, although Mrs. May has suffered two very, very serious defeats, which would have seen off any previous prime minister, she will be staying for the time being until we have got some kind of resolution. But there's no doubt at all that she is very, very severely wounded.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's James Blitz joining us from London, from an office there that sounds a little on the busy side. He's Whitehall editor for the Financial Times, and he writes their Brexit briefing. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Daniel Kellerman, political science professor at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick campus, where he is the Jean Monnet Chair in EU Politics. He's an EU specialist, and we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break, including the backstop. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, not paying any attention at all, talking with our guest here in our Philadelphia studio, Daniel Kellerman. James Blitz joining us from London. Daniel, I'm giving you the honors of explaining what the Irish backstop is all about and why that's important to our conversation.
All right. Well, yeah, it's tricky, but I think we can break it down. Really, the backstop, you have to think of it as a kind of insurance policy, and an insurance policy to deal with something that really has proved the ultimate sticking point in Brexit, which wasn't thought through or discussed much in the referendum, and that is the situation, the position of Northern Ireland. So let me explain. Essentially, Theresa May has made three promises, of which only two can be kept logically. She's got to pick two out of the three. So what are the three things? She said that the UK is going to leave the single market of the EU and its customs union. But then she said, but we're not going to reimpose a border on the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK,
right,
and the Republic of Ireland, because that would violate the Good Friday Agreement and could lead to new tensions, etc. So she also promised that. And then her third promise was, we're also not going to have a border or any kind of internal division between Great Britain, you know, the island of Great Britain, and Northern Ireland, right, which is still part of their country,
right.
Because that would be to create a division and a kind of constitutional problem within their own country. But here's the problem. If you leave the single market and customs union, you have to check goods and customs and things like that at some point. So you need a border. So where's the border going to be? It's either going to be between Ireland, right, and Northern Ireland, or there's going to be have to be some kind of checks at sort of at British ports coming across. So you've got to keep you can only keep two out of three. So the backstop basically is saying, well, during this withdrawal period, the British promise or hope was, well, we'll work something out. We'll find some solution for that conundrum. But then the EU said, well, in case you can't find a solution, right, we need a default safety valve. And sort of the default would be, right, in this backstop is no border on the island of Ireland, right, which essentially implies you are going to stay
in Northern Ireland and the Republic
of Ireland. Yeah, and essentially it would force them to stay in the customs union of the EU and in significant parts of the single market at least, right? And they don't want to be stuck. So the opponents of the backstop say, you can't force us to be trapped in this customs union. Then we can't sign our own trade deals, right? And then what's the point of Brexit?
Right. Oh, my goodness. James, anything you want to add to that?
Not really. I think he's explained it extremely well. I mean, it is, if you like, the basic problem. It's basically an insurance policy which the British have signed up to, which basically means that we will guarantee that there is an invisible border on the island of Ireland until we have reached a comprehensive trade agreement with the EU. The trouble is, a lot of hard Brexiters, people on the right of the Conservative Party, believe that we will never be able to leave that arrangement. That it's actually impossible for us to leave that arrangement. And that as a result, we will be part of the customs union arrangements of the European Union. And that means that we will never be able to sign our own trade deals. And that is fundamentally the reason why Mrs. May's deal has gone down. But a lot of people would argue it isn't a very good reason. And as I think you said earlier, I think Daniel said earlier, the bottom line is that Mrs. May was offering a way to leave the EU, a deal to leave the EU. And that by choosing this issue of the backstop to fight over, the hard Brexiters are risking the possibility that we won't leave the union at all.
So looking into your crystal ball there, James Bliss, looking into the future, we've got this deadline of March 29th. There's the elections in March involving the European Union. Where do you see this going? Where do you see this conclusion, if there is one?
I think it's really hard to say. I don't exclude the possibility that as we approach the March 29th date, Mrs. May tries one more time to get her deal past the House of Commons and try and get support for that. I still think that is a possibility. But I think if the stalemate continues, then other solutions are going to have their rear their heads. One of them, as I say, is the possibility of the European Economic Area and a very close trading relationship with the EU. And I don't think the second referendum is completely to be ignored. I still think no deal is very, very unlikely because the British Parliament doesn't want it. But it is possible that we might just slip away through sheer default.
How do you see it, Daniel?
Similarly to James, and I'd say if she wants to try to get this deal through still, because I think it's important first to say the EU has said this is our final offer, right? So it's this deal. So if she wants to get it through, she either has to get votes from the sort of hardcore Brexiters to her right, or else she has to try to do a kind of cross-party deal and get some votes from Labour MPs to come over to her side. So the first strategy is what she's been pursuing, you know, to get the people on her right hasn't really worked. Maybe she could try to say, yeah, we'll enter into a kind of permanent customs union, that sort of thing, and get some of the Labour voters. But I think one of the risks is, as destructive as the cliff edge no deal would be, I think we have to, you know, accept the possibility that some of the actors here may actually see benefits for themselves politically in that disaster. So, you know, Corbyn, for instance, on Labour Party. Yeah, the Labour Party, leader of the Labour Party, he may think, okay, well, it'll be a disaster temporarily, but she'll take the blame, then there'll be elections, and then I can come to power and, you know, pursue my vision, right? And then on the right, some of those hardcore Brexiters, one has to wonder when you see that they voted against, you know, this deal, you know, maybe they'd rather be sort of the martyrs, right, and go down and say, we were betrayed, you know, our Brexit would have been wonderful, but May couldn't deliver it, and then just get to keep complaining.
How do you, would you agree with that, James? Curious.
It's not impossible. I mean, Labour has played a very cynical game in many ways because it's never been very clear what it actually wants. It moves from one thing to another. There's no question, though, that if we had a no-deal Brexit, there's a lot of people in the Labour Party who think that it would do enormous damage, economic damage, to the kind of working class supporters of the Labour Party, people who find it very hard to make ends meet. There's certainly a lot for Labour to gain in terms of all this disruption that's happening within the Conservative Party. But in the end, I think Corbyn has one problem, which is that the vast majority of his rank and file, around 70% of Labour Party activists, actually would like to see a second referendum happening.
Oh, wow.
And I think one of the risks for Corbyn is that if we end up in a situation where May finally does get her deal through, I think there will be a very heavy reaction against him, not only from Labour activists, but also from the general public, which says he just didn't do what was necessary to try and stop Brexit happening and to put the second referendum to the public. So I think that one of the reasons we've got into this huge mess is not just that we've had really a very, very poor strategic leadership from Mrs. May, but also at the other end, on the opposition side, we've had a Labour leader who hasn't really thought strategically either, and who is basically rather Eurosceptic and wouldn't mind seeing Britain leave the EU and has never been clear in what he actually sees as the way forward. And that's one of the reasons why we're living this stalemate every day.
James, you're joining us from London. Are people in Britain, are they already feeling the effects of Brexit, even though it hasn't been officially taken place?
No, I mean, I think if you actually look, I mean, I think the British public is bored with the whole topic. I mean, this is a very, very complicated debate, basically, about trade. And it has been dominating the airwaves in the UK for nearly 3 years now. And I think most members of the public are fed up with the whole thing. But the trouble is that a lot of people think that once we actually leave the EU, the whole story will be over. In fact, we'll merely only be at the beginning, because we will then have to spend years working out what the trade relationship is. I think a lot of people in Britain think that Brexit is kind of just a very straightforward process, that once we leave, we're out, we'll move to a new world, and then we can get on with worrying about all the other things that worry people in this country, especially in terms of the underfunding of public services. But that isn't going to happen, unfortunately. But no, broadly speaking, the public is very switched off. There's very little sign at the moment that people are panicking in any way about no deal. But I think if we did finally look like we were moving towards that, I think the atmosphere in the country would change quite a bit.
Daniel, I'm giving you the last 30 seconds. Your thoughts?
Well, I'll just pick up on the last point James was making there, that some people are acting as though no deal is a kind of outcome, like, okay, well, it'll be done. Let's get it over with. But no deal is not a stable outcome, because there could be shortages of food, medicine, the existing trade deals will be teared up. You could have huge lines at the borders, et cetera. So it's just going to force the UK to go back to the negotiating table with the EU. But by then, they will no longer be a member. So the kind of option of this transition will be off the table.
Well, we're going to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us on Radio Times, bringing some clarity to a very complicated situation. Daniel Kellerman, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. And he's political science professor at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick campus. James Blitz, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. And again, James Blitz, a Whitehall editor for the Financial Times, and he writes their Brexit briefing. Well, now we travel from Britain to Florida and discuss a story involving a massage parlor chain, a Chinese-born businesswoman, and big Trump donor selling Chinese business executives access to President Trump and his family. Li Yang, who calls herself Cindy, came to the States about 20 years ago and founded a chain of spas and massage parlors. Turns out that Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, was charged with soliciting prostitution at a Jupiter, Florida spa that Yang used to own. More recently, she founded a consulting firm called GYUS Investments, offering Chinese investors access to the president, his family, and members of the administration, raising questions about pay to play. According to our guest, Yang is also affiliated with two groups with ties to the Chinese government, raising concerns about blackmail and espionage. Well, here to tell us more is Daniel Shulman, and he is D.C. Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Daniel Shulman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Li Yang. What do we know about her? She's been living in the U.S. for about, what, 20 years?
She's been living in the U.S. for about 20 years. According to her bio, she says that she worked as a journalist in Silicon Valley before, I guess, relocating to Florida and founding this chain of about 5 massage parlors and a beauty school. and around 2015 or 2016, she had never sort of displayed any political leanings, really. And she really plunged into politics, first helping to organize events for Jeb Bush and then backing Donald Trump. She was appointed to a Republican committee for Asian Americans, and it was also at this time where she became involved with 2 of these organizations that, as we reported, have links to the Chinese government.
And let me pick up on all of that. This chain, Orchids of Asia, is the chain that she and her family, as I understand it, own. Do they own any spas today or any massage parlors today?
Yes. Actually, the Orchids of Asia is the one that they don't own. Their chain is called Tokyo Spas. And they own a few to this day. She was starting some of these and flipping them, from what we can tell.
And is there any evidence of sex trafficking with her spas, massage parlors?
The Miami Herald reported that some of the parlors that her family owns have gained a reputation for offering sexual services, and at least 2 occasions reports have been made to the police about this.
But she says she's never been charged, and apparently she's never been charged with any of this.
Exactly, and she's denied any wrongdoing. And to be clear, she isn't implicated in anything related to the Kraft bust.
Well, what's so interesting is that it was photos of Kraft with Trump that led to photos of Li Yang and Trump, which I think sort of opened up this whole Pandora's box.
Exactly. I think, you know, the Miami Herald was the first to break the story of the fact that the former owner of this location where Kraft was arrested for allegedly soliciting prostitution was also, you know, pictured with Donald Trump at this recent Super Bowl party, as well as with a host of other Republican power brokers.
So tell us about this company, this firm that she started. I called it GYUS Investments. I'm hoping that's the name of it. But
that's right.
Explain what it offers and who the clients have been.
Well, so she started this company in 2017 along with her husband. And it offered a range of services, but one of them was, and this is literally spelled out on their website in Chinese, that they offer interactions with the president and members of Congress. They offer to arrange photo ops with the president, and they say they can arrange White House and congressional dinners. Now, some of this I'm a bit dubious about, but there's clear evidence that she was squiring Chinese business executives to various functions, including the New Year's Eve party at Mar-a-Lago, as well as a Republican National Committee fundraiser in New York that took place in 2017. And that really raises a lot of questions because foreign nationals cannot donate to campaigns. Green card holders can. But at this event that 400 people attended, there were as many as 100 Chinese nationals, which is extremely unusual. And the big question is who paid for them to attend.
Because do we know?
No, we don't. It was $2,700 a head to go at a minimum. And that's a big open question. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if the authorities might be investigating that now.
Is the implication that Li Yang paid for all these Chinese to go to this fundraiser?
It's unclear, but that's possible. But the question is, if she was reimbursed or if she was paid by them, that would be a violation of the law.
There are photos of her of some of these executives at Mar-a-Lago. What do they reveal?
You know, they show some of these executives posing with Donald Trump Jr., with Eric Trump. There's photos of people with the president's sister, Elizabeth Trump Grau. Now, it's unclear what they were actually trying to achieve. Now, one of the people that did attend the New Year's Eve party and flew 17 hours from China to do so was runs an electric car company. And he said He told Yahoo that one of the reasons why he wanted to attend was to promote his brand in the hopes of getting his company listed on the New York Stock Exchange at some point. So he had a very specific objective. In the case of some of the others who Yang was helping out, it's possible that they were using these photo ops with the president or with members of his family as a type of currency back home in China, where connections are incredibly, incredibly important. And there's, you know, there's a word, Guangxi, that people use for well-connected people. So it's possible that some of this was not intended to influence U.S. policy, but was intended to work back at home.
Well, which does raise a question. Was this this company, this firm, GYUS Investments, were they just sort of over-promising their clients, you know, access when all they really ended up with all they ended up with was a photograph?
It's, you know, it might have been that a lot of these people just wanted the photograph to show. But then again, the ability of these executives to get in that type of proximity to the president and his family raises a number of kind of alarming questions, national security questions, especially given Yang's association with two organizations that have close ties to the Chinese government. Now, to be clear, you know, there's no evidence that she was involved in any type of espionage. But that's often not how exactly how this works. Because of her affiliation with these groups, including the Florida chapter of the Council for the Promotion of Peaceful Reunification, which is a branch of one of many of an organization founded in China, and it's under the oversight of the Chinese government, and they use that to project influence abroad and keep tabs on the Chinese diaspora.
You know, Daniel, hold on to that thought only because sure. We're very up on our break here. Daniel Shulman, D.C. Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne talking with Daniel Shulman. He's D.C. Bureau Chief for Mother Jones and has been covering this ever-evolving story involving a massage parlor chain owned by a Chinese-born businesswoman and allegations of selling business executives access to President Trump and his family. You can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Daniel, you were describing, besides having this company that hooked business executives up with the Trump family or the Trump administration, there was this Council for the Promotion of the Peaceful Reunification of China that Cindy Yang or Yang Li was Li Yang was affiliated with. Can you flesh that out for us?
Sure. There are chapters of this organization throughout the world, and the Chinese government basically uses it to project its influence. It is under the direct oversight of a Chinese agency called the United Front Work Department, and Yang was one of the founding members of the Florida chapter, and you know, Chinese consular officials attended it and sent congratulatory notes. Now, the issue that's raised here is, and again, there's no evidence that she was directly involved in any type of espionage.
Right.
But the Chinese government would have been well aware of her activities and could have easily exploited that. And the issues raised here are much bigger than just Cindy Yang, really. It goes to the heart of the president's ongoing conflicts of interest with his business interests, which he has done not nearly enough to separate himself from. And you've seen numerous examples of people using their proximity and access to the president, including at Mar-a-Lago, to promote their, you know, to promote their private interests or pet causes.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. In terms of her association with the Council for the Promotion of the Peaceful Reunification of China, that's the idea that China would absorb Taiwan, I guess, and make one China. That is in direct opposition to U.S. policy. Are there questions about what this means about U.S. policy?
I mean, well, I think the the big question is we've been engaged in these contentious trade negotiations with China, and stuff like this has been happening behind the scenes where Chinese nationals may very well be trying to affect the outcome of policy here.
Because the Chinese government allegedly knew what was going on, but perhaps the U.S. government did not.
I think it's very likely that the Chinese government was aware that Cindy Yang was offering to squire Chinese executives to Republican Party fundraisers and to Mar-a-Lago, where they could rub elbows with not just the president and his family, but other people that are in his circle. And you certainly saw her, very openly advertising both on the website of her company and on her Facebook page, encounters she had with the head of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, Kellyanne Conway, Ron DeSantis, Elaine Chao, Rick Scott. I mean, the list really went on and on.
What do U.S. intelligence agencies, what do they say about this?
They're not talking about this specific episode, but in recent years, intelligence officials have been very concerned about covert Chinese influence in the United States. So it would stand to reason that this is something that would be worrisome to them. Former intelligence community officials who have commented on this story have just said that it raises huge, huge national security risks. At this point, it's unclear how someone like Yang would have been able to get so close to the president, given that her affiliations might have raised some questions. And it's unclear what type of vetting procedures are used at Mar-a-Lago or whether it's just a matter of paying your membership dues.
Well, let me pick up on that. I'm assuming that when anyone is close to the president, there are, for instance, Secret Service, or you have to go through a metal detector. Or there's some kind of security that protects the president from people who might do him harm. Are you saying at places like Mar-a-Lago, it's much more lax than that?
Well, I think there are certainly security procedures to prevent people from doing him harm. There are not as many procedures in place for people putting ideas in his mind and talking to him. Those don't seem to exist. Otherwise, some of the people that have come through Mar-a-Lago, probably wouldn't be there.
Well, do we know the kind of vetting that takes place at a place like Mar-a-Lago?
No, and that's something that we asked about.
And the answer being?
They didn't respond. And so far, the White House response has been solely, the president doesn't know Cindy Yang. And they refused to address the other questions raised by her activities.
And for U.S. intelligence experts, spying, blackmail, these are the things that at least concern them at this point?
Espionage, blackmail, influence. It's, at Mar-a-Lago, you could very easily insert a spy, basically, who is not just – who is picking up intelligence from people who are in the president's orbit that could be useful in some way.
Is this unusual in that we have a president who owns all these private properties and, travels from one to the other and sort of living in this public world of being the president, but also having these private business properties?
The mingling of the public's business and his personal business interests in this administration is just unprecedented. And it's created a lot of questions about corruption. Mar-a-Lago, in many ways, is an invitation to corruption, because basically you can pay to become a member there. There's evidence. ProPublica has done a lot of good stories about how Mar-a-Lago members have basically stovepiped policy proposals to the president, who has sent them on to agencies, to the Veterans Administration, perhaps among others. So, it's a magnet for potential corruption.
Is part of the problem the China collection, connection, I should say? If she were an American-born businesswoman, would there be the same kind of concerns? But the fact that she has these or had these affiliations with some of these Chinese-related groups that had ties to the Communist Party in China, is that the concerning factor in this story?
I think this would be problematic under any circumstances, whether you're sort of a U.S.-born or a foreign national. But in this case, it raises potential espionage concerns. You had folks like Elliot Broidy, who was the Republican, a big Republican National Committee fundraiser, and who was going to Mar-a-Lago and squiring people around there. And while he was also working on behalf of foreign governments that he hoped to do business with. So I think there are, you know, anyone who is peddling access to the president and his family or members of Congress, you know, that raises issues.
And that's Daniel Shulman. He's the D.C. Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., and has been covering the story involving a Chinese-born businesswoman and allegations of selling business executives access to President Trump, his family, and the administration as well. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Kat wants to know, will these activities implicate the president, and could they lead to an investigation into him and his administration? Daniel, can we answer that question?
I think it's unclear at this point. My guess is that, you know, the White House has said that the president did not know Cindy Yang, and I would tend to think that that was true, and she wasn't, you know, she was just posing in pictures with him. But the Southern District of New York is currently investigating straw donors to the president's inaugural committee. And, you know, basically it was foreign interest using potentially using middlemen, U.S. citizens, to donate. And I think that's where you could see the investigation happen. The big question is where, you know, was Cindy Yang donating purely her own money to the president and other Republican causes, or was she funneling it on behalf of others?
And just to underscore what you're saying there, it is illegal for foreigners to donate to political campaigns.
For foreign nationals.
Green
card holders can.
But if you're not a green card holder, if you are a foreigner without a green card, you cannot donate to a political campaign.
You cannot. And you can't do things like reimburse someone for the cost of a ticket to a fundraiser. So that's why there are some serious questions raised about this December 2017 fundraiser in New York. And the fact that this happened in New York also means that it would fall under the potential jurisdiction of the Southern District's investigation.
Oh, interesting. Was the president there at that 2017?
He was.
Party, right?
Yeah, it was a fundraising luncheon, I think.
And have you talked with Cindy or Li Yang?
No, you know, she didn't respond to any of our attempts to get in touch with her. We tried a number of phone numbers, and, you know, a couple times a man picked up and basically just said, I don't speak very good English, and hung up.
And hung up. So you're kind of and how about her company, GYUS Investments? Is that still functional? Do we know?
She took down the website. I mean, it's unclear how much of a company it actually was, how much business she was actually doing. Clearly, she was doing some. Yesterday or the day before, I think Cindy Yang's mother actually spoke out and just said, oh, you know, Cindy's always trying to impress people and sort of downplayed all of this.
You had mentioned one of her clients. Do we know how many clients she had that were and do we know what they paid to have this access?
It's totally unclear. I mean, we've seen about, you know, a half dozen or more. In terms of this Republican National Committee fundraiser, she apparently kind of motioned to this large group of Chinese nationals that were there and said, you know, all these folks are with me. So it could be a fairly substantial amount. Now, she was also soliciting Chinese investments in U.S. projects through a special visa program called EB-5 that has been a bit controversial, where basically you can pay for a green card by investing a certain amount in U.S. projects. One of them was actually a development that was about a half mile from Mar-a-Lago.
Hmm. You actually tweeted out a story from Mother Jones just about a year ago, or actually 2 years ago, March 15th, 2017, a businesswoman who bought Trump's bought a Trump penthouse. And is that part of this story, do you think?
In certain ways, all of this is about conflicts of interest and the president mingling his private business with his with the public's business. And in this case, a woman named Angela Chen, who is from China, bought a $16 million penthouse from Trump in 2017. Now, this raises questions because is this evidence of, you know, China putting money in the president's pocket somehow? She, like Yang, had ties to groups that had at least one group that had government ties. And in fact, it was kind of seen as a front for Chinese intelligence. So that raises a major set of concerns.
I'm also looking at something else you tweeted, and this having to do with the party at Mar-a-Lago. So I guess this was the New Year's party. The president wasn't there because of the shutdown. Is that correct?
Correct. But his sons were there, and his sister, Elizabeth Trump Grau, was there.
And apparently one of the people there was a Russian, said the most interesting thing is that we met a lot of people who speak Russian at that party. Just to add to
it's fascinating, right?
To the story here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's sort of, Mar-a-Lago is kind of like that bar in Star Wars where it's just a collection of opportunists and schemers, and you never know who you're potentially going to meet there. Very much like the lobby of the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C.,
So what are you going to look at next? Where do you think this story goes, or are we at the end as far as you can tell?
Oh, I think, you know, my supposition is that there are many more Cindy Yangs out there. And I don't just mean people that might be exerting influence on behalf of China. I mean people that might be doing this on behalf of an array of other foreign governments, as well as people who are doing it on behalf of business interests. So I think that's where this story goes.
And is that corruption?
In my view, it is. You know, it's basically creating opportunities to pay for access to the president. You know, the people who are attending events at Mar-a-Lago or who are signing up for membership there, which costs $200,000 and $14,000 a year after that, are basically putting their money directly into the president's pocket. There's certainly, you know, that certainly raises the potential for corruption.
Do you think Congress has the appetite to delve into things like this?
Oh, I think this is certainly something that the House would look into. And, you know, the Government Accountability Office is also looking at a specific case where basically several Mar-a-Lago members were providing Veterans Administration policy advice to the president and were actually, you know, sitting on contract and conference calls and things like that, which raises, you know, major issues. So that's something that the GAO is looking at.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Daniel Shulman, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Anytime.
And he is the D.C. Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, again, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. We began with Brexit and ended with this story. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and come watch Stacey Abrams be interviewed on Radio Times the first Friday in April. You can go to whyy.org/events for more information. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.